A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello, Herman and Corn. I'd like to pick up on one more topic from the fascinating episode about puppetry, which is extremely entertaining. And you mentioned that one of the moments of puppetry's growing acceptance in the mainstream came from a Broadway production that lasted for 6 years, which in Broadway terms is very impressive. You mentioned that it, I think, began as an off-Broadway show. And My mother and my sister are both devoted fans of the genre called musicals. And during a couple of trips to New York City and to London, their first priority was to pick up tickets for musicals. So think about the big show productions, which I have to say, I can't say they're quite my cup of tea, but I do recall the orchestra and the guy when you come in who's got all those consoles open. That was what really impressed me. The production is impressive, but I've always been intrigued. You mentioned that it was an off-Broadway, and you know, I've heard that there's various grades of off-Broadway production. Some people talk about off-Broadway, and you can maybe go in degrees there. But what does this scene actually look like? Because you know, the type of person that I am, if I was spending any time in New York City and wanted to see theater, I would probably start with the most obscure, hacky, experimentary, weird production that was out there. That would appeal to me far more than anything that was showing on the, you know, the big box show. So I'm really interested in, you know, what this term actually means in terms of the scene, the productions, and the level of professionalism. Because if you go to a Broadway production, you are kind of in awe just at the physical endurance that everyone in the production, all the actors, you know, these guys practice for hours and hours a day, and they're in absolutely peak physical condition. So it's not a hobby. But what does the world of off-Broadway actually look like in terms of both productions and writers and actors that are trying to break through? Where is it clustered in New York, so that the next time I'm in the city, I would definitely want to make it on my agenda. But where do I actually start to see what's showing, what's worth checking out, what's the community, where does it happen?
Daniel sent us this one about off-Broadway theatre, and it's a good question because people throw around off-Broadway like it just means smaller Broadway, and that's not quite it. He wants to know what the scene actually looks like, where it's clustered in New York, how to find the weird experimental stuff, and what the professional ladder looks like for actors and writers trying to break through. And honestly, the geography alone tells you a lot.
It really does. And before we get into it, quick note, today's script is being written by DeepSeek Vi4 Pro, so thank you to our Silicon friend for the assist. Now Daniel, you mentioned that Broadway puppetry show we talked about, which ran 6 years and started off. Broadway. That's actually a perfect case study because it illustrates exactly what off-Broadway is structurally, not just artistically.
And to be clear, that show was Avenue Q. It opened off-Broadway at the Vineyard Theatre in 2003, transferred to Broadway later that year, and ran until 2009. 6 years on Broadway for a show with puppet nudity is not nothing.
It won the Tony for Best Musical over Wicked. People forget that. But here's the thing. The Vineyard Theater seats about 130 people. That's off-Broadway. The John Golden Theater on Broadway seats about 800. Same show, same cast, completely different economic model, completely different risk profile, completely different union contracts.
That's where we should probably start, because the definitions are actually legal and contractual, not artistic. Most people think off-Broadway means edgy, or small, or experimental, and it can be those things, but the actual definition is about seat count.
In New York theater, the classification is purely about the number of seats in the house. Broadway theaters have 500 or more seats, and they're located in the theater district, mostly between 41st Street and 54th Street, and between 6th and 8th Avenues. Off-Broadway is between 100 and 499 seats. Off-Off-Broadway is under 100 seats.
Those numbers aren't arbitrary. They're baked into contracts with Actors' Equity, the Stagehands Union, the Musicians Union, everything. The minimum salary for an actor on Broadway is different from off-Broadway. The royalty structures are different. The marketing budgets are different. So when a show moves from off-Broadway to Broadway, it's not just getting a nicer dressing room. The entire financial architecture changes.
That's what makes off-Broadway so interesting as an ecosystem. It's not just Broadway's minor league. It's a parallel universe with its own economics, its own star system, and its own geography. You mentioned wanting to know where to go in New York to find the weird stuff. The answer has shifted over the decades, but there are two major clusters.
Let's hear them.
The first is Theater Row on 42nd Street between 9th and 10th Avenues. That's a complex of six off-Broadway theaters developed in the 1970s as part of a city-led effort to revitalize that stretch of 42nd Street, which at the time was, let's be diplomatic, not exactly the tourist destination it is now. There's the Acorn Theater, the Beckett Theater, the Clurman Theater, the Kirk Theater, the Lion Theater, and the Studio Theater. They're all in one building complex, and they're all under 200 seats.
That concentration matters because it creates a kind of critical mass. You can walk down that block on any given night and have six shows to choose from, all within 100 yards of each other. It's like a festival that runs year-round.
The second major cluster is the East Village and Lower East Side. That's where you find the really experimental stuff. The Public Theater on Lafayette Street, which is technically off-Broadway in its smaller spaces, but also produces work that transfers to Broadway, including Hamilton. La Mama on East 4th Street. New York Theater Workshop on East 4th. The Orpheum on 2nd Avenue. Performance Space, New York, which used to be PS 122. That corridor from about East 1st to East 9th between 2nd Avenue and Avenue A is probably the densest concentration of innovative theater in America.
La MoMA specifically is worth calling out because it's been running since 1961. Ellen Stewart started it in a basement on East 9th Street, and it became one of the birthplaces of the off-off-Broadway movement. Sam Shepard, Philip Glass, Blue Man Group. They all came through La MoMA early.
Blue Man Group is actually a great example of the trajectory. They started as street performers, then did experimental pieces at La MoMA and PS 122 in the late 80s, then moved to the Astor Place Theater off-Broadway in 1991, and they're still there. That's a 30-plus year off-Broadway run. They never went to Broadway. They didn't need to. The 400-seat Astor Place works perfectly for what they do.
That's an important point. The assumption that every show aspires to Broadway is wrong. Some shows are designed for a mid-sized house and would actually lose money or lose intimacy if they moved to a larger venue. The economics of a 400-seat theater are completely different from an 800-seat theater. You can run at 80% capacity off-Broadway and be profitable in a way that would be a disaster on Broadway.
Let me put some numbers on that. A Broadway musical typically costs between $10 and $20 million to mount, and the weekly running cost can be $600,000 to $800,000. That means you need to gross at least that much every single week just to stay open. At an average ticket price of, say, $130 and an 800-seat house, you're looking at a maximum weekly gross of about $728,000 if you sell out every performance. So even at full capacity, the margins are thin.
That's why so many Broadway shows close quickly. They're not failing artistically. They're failing mathematically.
Off-Broadway, by contrast, you can mount a play for anywhere from $250,000 to $2 million, and weekly running costs might be $30,000 to $100,000. You can stay open for months on modest ticket sales. You can take risks. You can develop work over time rather than needing to be a blockbuster out of the gate.
Which brings us to what Daniel's actually asking about, the weird, experimental, hacky stuff. Where does that live, and who's making it?
The short answer is off-off-Broadway, the under 100-seat category. And that's where the scene gets genuinely interesting because it's not one scene. It's dozens of micro-scenes, each with its own aesthetic, its own funding model, and its own audience.
Give me the taxonomy.
At the top of the off-off-Broadway food chain, you've got the established nonprofit institutions. The Public Theater has its Shiva Theater and its Lou Esther Hall, both under 100 seats, where they develop new work. New York Theater Workshop has a 99-seat house. The Signature Theater, now at the Pershing Square Signature Center on 42nd Street, has 3 spaces, and their smallest is about 160 seats, technically off-Broadway, but the aesthetic is very much in that developmental, writer-focused tradition.
Signature is interesting because they do full-season residencies with a single playwright. Edward Albee, Tony Kushner, Suzanne Laurie Parks. They get a whole season of productions, which is almost unheard of in the commercial theater.
Then below the established nonprofits, you've got the storefront theaters. These are companies that rent or own small spaces, often converted retail storefronts, hence the name, seating anywhere from 30 to 99. The Flea Theater in Tribeca. The Brick in Williamsburg. Here Arts Center on 6th Avenue. The Tank on West 36th Street. These are places where you can see work for $20 or $30, sometimes pay what you can, and the production values range from remarkably polished to gloriously ramshackle.
The Tank is a good example. I believe they do something like 1,000 performances a year across multiple disciplines. Theater, dance, comedy, music. And a lot of it is work that's still finding its shape.
That's the point. Off-off, Broadway isn't just a smaller version of off-Broadway. It's a fundamentally different thing. The union rules are different. Below 99 seats, Actors Equity has a separate contract called the Showcase Code, which allows actors to work for a stipend rather than full salary. The idea is that these are developmental productions, showcases for the work and the performers, not commercial runs. There are restrictions on the number of performances, usually 16 or fewer, and there are limits on ticket prices.
If you're Daniel wandering into a 30-seat black box on the Lower East Side, you're probably seeing actors who are working for a $50 stipend, or maybe just transportation reimbursement, doing it because they believe in the material, or because they want to be seen by agents and casting directors.
Agents and casting directors do go to these shows. That's a real part of the ecosystem. A showcase production at a well-regarded off-off Broadway venue can lead to representation, which can lead to auditions for off-Broadway and Broadway productions. It's not a myth.
Let's talk about the venues Daniel should actually know about if he's looking for the obscure and experimental end of things. You mentioned a few, but let's build a proper list.
If you want the adventurous stuff, start with The Brick in Williamsburg. They're known for genre-bending work, a lot of it devised by ensembles rather than scripted by a single playwright. They do an annual festival called the Exponential Festival every January, which is basically a month-long survey of the most experimental theater happening in Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan.
Williamsburg is its own little theater district now, isn't it? The Brick, the Bushwick Star, Target Margin Theater, they're all within walking distance of each other.
The Bushwick Star is excellent. They moved into a new space on Elder Street in 2022, a converted warehouse, 100 seats. They premiered work that's gone on to national tours. Target Margin is on South 4th Street in Williamsburg, and their whole thing is reconsidering classic texts. They'll take a Greek tragedy and strip it down to its bones and rebuild it with a completely different aesthetic.
Then you've got the Downtown Manhattan Cluster. Here, Art Center on 6th Avenue near Spring Street. That's been around since 1993. 3 performance spaces, all small. They're known for multidisciplinary work. Theater that incorporates puppetry, video art, live music. The late Basil Twist did some of his most famous underwater puppet pieces there.
Oh, Basil Twist. Symphony Fantastique, his abstract puppet piece performed entirely in a water tank, ran it here for months. That's the kind of thing you can only do in a small, flexible venue. You cannot put a 1,000-gallon water tank in a Broadway house. Well, you could, but the insurance alone would destroy you.
That's exactly what Daniel's looking for, right? The thing you can't see anywhere else. The thing that exists only because someone had a weird idea and found a 99-seat theater willing to take a chance.
He should also know about Soho Rep on Walker Street, 65 seats. But they've been around since 1975, and their track record for spotting major playwrights early is remarkable. Annie Baker, Brandon Jacobs, Jenkins, Lucas Hanoth, all did early work at Soho Rep. Jackie Sibley's Drury's Fairview, which won the Pulitzer in 2019, premiered there.
The space itself is part of the aesthetic. Soho Rep is basically a triangle-shaped room. The audience is on 3 sides. There's no backstage to speak of. The actors are right there, inches from the front row. It creates a kind of intensity that you simply cannot replicate in a larger venue.
That's one of the things that makes Off-Off Broadway special. The architecture forces a different relationship between performer and audience. No one is more than about 20 feet from the stage. You can see the sweat, you can hear the breathing. If something goes wrong, you know it. There's no hiding behind production values.
Let's get practical. Daniel wants to know how to actually find these shows when he's in New York. He's not going to stumble across a storefront production in the East Village by accident. Well, he might, but let's give him a better strategy.
The best aggregator is probably the TDF, the Theater Development Fund. They run the TKTS booths, but their website and their membership program list off Broadway and Off-Off Broadway shows alongside Broadway. They also have a publication called TDF Stages that covers the whole ecosystem. For the more experimental end, CultureBot is an online publication that's been covering downtown performance since 2003. They're very good on the weird stuff.
Show Score, which is a review aggregator that covers all of New York theater, not just Broadway. You can filter by Off-Broadway and Off-Off-Broadway and sort by critical reception. It's useful because the New York Times will review the major Off-Broadway houses, but won't always cover the 30-seat productions.
The Times has a critic, Laura Collins Hughes is one of them, who specifically covers downtown and experimental work, but they can't cover everything, so you need the smaller outlets. The Brooklyn Rail covers a lot of experimental performance. There's a newer site called American Theater, the magazine from Theater Communications Group, which has solid Off-Broadway coverage.
Honestly, the most reliable method might be the most analog one. Walk into the Drama Bookshop on West 39th Street and look at the bulletin board. Or just pick up a Village Voice, which still publishes, and check the theater listings. The Off-Off Broadway world still runs on flyers and word of mouth in a way that Broadway doesn't.
The Drama Bookshop is a good call. It's been around since 1917. It's now co-owned by Lin-Manuel Miranda and some of his Hamilton collaborators who bought it to keep it from closing. It's a hub. The staff know what's happening. You can literally walk in and say, "I want to see something strange tonight," and they'll point you somewhere.
That's the thing about this scene. It's not just geographically clustered. It's socially clustered. There are bars and restaurants where theater people congregate. Joe Allen on West 46th Street is the classic Broadway hangout. But for the off-Broadway crowd, it's more like Vaughan on Bleecker Street, or the bar at the Public Theater. You overhear conversations. You hear about what people saw last night.
The Public Theater Lobby Bar is actually legendary for this. It's called The Library, and it's open to the public even if you're not seeing a show. On any given night, you'll find playwrights, directors, actors, and audience members all mingling. It's probably the single best place in New York to absorb theater gossip and find out about shows that aren't in any listing.
Now, you mentioned the union contracts earlier, and I think that's worth going deeper on because it shapes what Daniel would actually see on stage. What's the talent level like? He mentioned being in awe of the physical conditioning of Broadway performers. Is Off-Broadway a step down in terms of performance quality?
It's not a step down. It's often the same performers. An actor might do a Broadway run for a year, then do an Off-Broadway play for 6 weeks because the material interests them. The pay is lower, but the artistic freedom is often higher. You don't have to deliver the same performance 8 times a week for 18 months. You can take risks.
The physical demands are different, but not necessarily lesser. A Broadway musical is an athletic event, absolutely. But a 60-seat black box where you're doing an intense 2-character drama and the audience is 3 feet away, that's a different kind of endurance. You can't coast. There's no ensemble number to hide in.
The intimacy is exhausting in its own way. I've talked to actors who say a 90-minute off-off Broadway show leaves them more drained than a 2.5-hour Broadway musical just because of the intensity of the connection with the audience. You're not projecting to the back row. You're having what amounts to a conversation with 40 people.
The writing talent? Daniel asked about writers trying to break through. What does that pipeline look like?
The pipeline is real, but it's narrow. A playwright typically starts in the off-off-Broadway world. They might get a production at a small venue through a company's open submission process or through a developmental program. If that goes well, they might get picked up by a more established off-Broadway theater. Playwrights Horizons, The Vineyard, Second Stage, Manhattan Theater Club, smaller spaces. If that production is a hit, it might transfer to Broadway or get produced at one of the major regional theaters.
The timeline on that can be years or decades. Annie Baker's first play was produced in 2006 at the Ontological Hysteric Theater, which was Richard Foreman's tiny space in St. Mark's Church. She didn't reach Broadway until 2023 with Infinite Life. That's 17 years.
That's fast, relatively speaking. Most playwrights never reach Broadway. They have careers entirely in the off-Broadway ecosystem, and that's not a failure. That's a viable artistic life. You can make a living writing for off-Broadway and regional theater. You're not going to get rich, but you can pay rent and do meaningful work.
Let's talk about some of the institutional players that support this. You mentioned Playwrights Horizons and Second Stage. What should Daniel know about those?
Playwrights Horizons is on West 42nd Street, right in the theater district. They've been around since 1971. They're dedicated to developing American playwrights, and their alumni list is extraordinary. Stephen Sondheim did work there, William Finn, James Lapine, Lynn Nottage, Sarah Rule. They have a main stage that seats about 200 and a smaller space upstairs. They do full productions with professional casts and designers, but the focus is always on the script. Second Stage has two venues, a 300-seat off-Broadway house on West 43rd Street and the Hayes Theater on West 44th Street, which is actually a Broadway house. They're unique in that they operate in both worlds. They'll develop a play off-Broadway and then, if it's strong enough, move it to their Broadway space. They did Dear Evan Hansen that way, and The Humans, and Next to Normal.
Then there's the Roundabout Theater Company, which is a bit different. They're a non-profit, but they operate three Broadway houses, the American Airlines, Studio 54, and the Stephen Sondheim, plus two off-Broadway spaces, the Laura Pels and the Black Box Theater. They do classics and revivals alongside new work. Their model is essentially a subscription-based non-profit that happens to operate on Broadway.
The subscription model is key to understanding how off-Broadway non-profits survive. Playwrights Horizons, Second Stage, Roundabout, Manhattan Theater Club. They all rely on subscribers who buy season packages. That provides a base of revenue that allows them to take risks on new work. A commercial Broadway producer can't do that. They need a hit. A nonprofit can program a season that includes a challenging new play alongside a revival that they know will sell tickets.
If Daniel wants to sample this world efficiently, he could theoretically buy a subscription to one of these companies and see four or five shows over the course of a season, and that would give him a curated tour of what's happening at the professional off-Broadway level.
And most of these companies have flexible subscription packages. You can do three-show packages, you can do choose your own, you can do preview performances at a discount. Preview tickets at Playwrights Horizons can be as low as $40, which for New York theater is remarkably affordable.
Daniel specifically said he wants the obscure, hacky, experimental stuff, so let's go deeper into that end. What's the weirdest thing currently happening in New York theater?
The nature of the experimental scene is that it changes constantly, but there are some venues that are consistently producing work that pushes boundaries. The Chocolate Factory in Long Island City is one. It's a 40-seat theater in an old factory building, and their whole thing is supporting artists who work across disciplines, people who don't fit neatly into playwright or director or choreographer. They give artists residencies and let them develop work over long periods.
Queens is becoming a theater destination in its own right. Not just Long Island City. Astoria has a cluster of small venues now. The Variety Boys and Girls Club of Queens has a theater program. There's the Secret Theater on 44th Drive.
The Secret Theater is fun. They do a mix of classics and new work, and their whole aesthetic is scrappy and inventive. They've got about 90 seats. They're not trying to be polished. They're trying to be alive.
Another venue Daniel should know about is the Connolly Theater on East 4th Street. It's a 150-seat space in a former school building, and it's become a hub for some of the most interesting young theater companies in the city. The space is rented out to independent producers, so the programming is wildly eclectic. You might see a radical adaptation of a Chekhov play one week, and an original musical about cryptocurrency the next.
The Connolly is a good example of the rental model that sustains a lot of off-off Broadway. The theater owns the space and rents it to productions by the week or by the run. The producers take the financial risk, but they don't have to maintain a building. It lowers the barrier to entry significantly.
That rental model exists at multiple price points. At the high end, you've got spaces like New York Live Arts in Chelsea, a beautifully equipped theatre that rents to dance and theatre companies. At the low end, you've got spaces like the Crane Theatre on East 4th Street, which has about 60 seats and rents for a few hundred dollars a night. The Crane is part of the Horse Trade Theatre Group, which operates several small venues in the East Village.
The Crane is practically a landmark of the off-off-Broadway scene. It's been hosting experimental work since the 1990s. It's not fancy. The seats are folding chairs. The dressing room is basically a closet. But the list of people who've performed there is impressive.
That's the thing about this world. The glamour is in the work, not the venue. You're sitting on a folding chair in a basement watching someone pour their entire soul into a performance for 40 people. That's the experience Daniel's looking for. Not the chandeliers and the velvet seats.
The economics of that experience are fascinating. A production at the Crane might cost $5,000 to mount. The producers might sell tickets for $20. If they sell out a run of 12 performances at 60 seats, they gross about $14,400. Subtract the rental, the stipends, the marketing, the design elements, they might break even or make a small profit. But nobody's doing it for the money. They're doing it because they have something to say.
Let's talk about the festivals, because those are another entry point for someone like Daniel. The New York International Fringe Festival used to be the big one. It ran every August for 20 years and presented hundreds of shows across multiple venues downtown. It went on hiatus for a while, but there's a new festival called Fringe NYC that's trying to revive the model.
Fringe NYC is now run by the New York Theater Festival, and they've been doing summer and winter festivals. The format is familiar. Dozens of shows, multiple venues, relatively low ticket prices, and a lottery system for participation. It's a good way to see a lot of work in a compressed period and to stumble across something unexpected.
Then there's the Exponential Festival in January, which you mentioned. That's specifically focused on experimental work in Brooklyn. Under the Radar, which is the Public Theater's Festival of International and Experimental Work, happens in January as well. So January is actually a great month for adventurous theater in New York, which surprises people because they think of January as a dead zone.
January is the secret season for New York theater. The tourists are gone, the weather is terrible, and the people who are in town are the people who really care about the work. The Public's Under the Radar Festival brings in companies from all over the world. I've seen work from Iran, from Japan, from Brazil, from South Africa, and it's all in the Public's smaller spaces. It's curated by Mark Russell, who's been running it since 2005, and his taste is impeccable.
The Public Theater itself is worth describing as a physical space, because it's unusual. It's at 425 Lafayette Street, in a former Astor Library building that dates from the 1850s. It's a landmark. It houses five theater spaces, ranging from the 275-seat Anspacher Theater down to the 99-seat Shiva. Joe Papp founded it as the Shakespeare Workshop in 1954, and it's been the most important non-profit theater in America for decades.
Joe Papp is a whole episode on his own. He basically invented the modern non-profit theater model. He fought Robert Moses to save the building. He insisted on free Shakespeare in Central Park. He brought hair to Broadway and then used the profits to fund experimental work downtown. The Public's whole identity is that mix of commercial success and artistic risk-taking.
That model has been replicated across the country. Most major American cities now have a flagship non-profit theater that operates something like the Public, the Steppenwolf in Chicago, the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. They all have a similar structure, a main stage for higher profile work and smaller spaces for development and experimentation.
New York is unique in the density. You can see more theater in a week in New York than you can in the year in most cities. And the range is extraordinary. On a single night, you could see a Broadway spectacle with a cast of 40 and a full orchestra, and then walk 10 blocks and see a solo show in a 40-seat basement. That's not possible anywhere else.
Let's give Daniel a practical itinerary. He's in New York. He wants to see the experimental scene. What does he do?
Step 1. Check show score and filter for off-off, Broadway. Look for shows with strong audience reviews. The score is out of 100, and anything above an 85 is probably worth your time. Step 2. Check the listings on Culturebot and the Brooklyn Rail for critical perspectives. Step 3. Look at what's playing at the venues we mentioned. The Brick, Bushwick Star, Soho Rep, Harry, La Mama, New York Theatre Workshop, The Tank, The Connolly. Step 4, if it's January, go to Under the Radar. If it's summer, check the Fringe Festival schedule.
Don't overplan. Leave room for serendipity. Walk into the drama bookshop. Talk to people. Go to a show on a whim. The best thing about the off-off-Broadway scene is that tickets are cheap enough that you can take risks. If a show is terrible, you're out $25 in 90 minutes. If it's brilliant, you'll remember it for years.
The hit rate is honestly higher than people expect. The work that gets produced at these venues has already been through a selection process. Someone has read the script, seen a workshop, believed in it enough to put resources behind it. It may not be to your taste, but it's rarely lazy.
Let's talk about one more aspect that Daniel might find interesting. The role of the commercial off-Broadway transfer. We mentioned Avenue Q, but there's a whole ecology of shows that start in non-profit off-Broadway houses and then move to commercial off-Broadway runs, sometimes without ever going to Broadway.
That's a crucial part of the ecosystem. A show like The Play That Goes Wrong started at a small theater in London, transferred to an off-Broadway house in New York, and then just stayed there. It's been running for years at New World Stages on West 50th Street, which is a complex of 5 off-Broadway theaters that specifically hosts long-running commercial productions. It's not Broadway, but it's also not a 6-week nonprofit run. It's a commercial enterprise operating at a scale that makes sense for the show.
New World Stages is interesting because it's essentially an off-Broadway multiplex. 5 theaters under one roof, ranging from 199 to 499 seats, all designed for open-ended commercial runs. Jersey Boys is there now. The Play That Goes Wrong. A couple of magic shows. It's a different model from the non-profit houses, and it's a reminder that off-Broadway isn't all non-profit and experimental.
There's a commercial off-Broadway sector that produces work that's too intimate or too niche for a Broadway house, but still has commercial potential. These productions use different union contracts, the Off-Broadway League contract rather than the Broadway League contract, and the economics are completely different, but it's still for-profit theater.
Then there's the not-for-profit commercial hybrid, where a non-profit theater develops a show, and then partners with commercial producers to move it to Broadway, or to a commercial off-Broadway run. The non-profit gets a share of the profits, which helps fund their future work. It's a virtuous cycle when it works.
Hamilton is the most famous example, developed at the Public Theater, which is a non-profit. The Public's production was in their 275-seat Anspacher Theater. It was an off-Broadway production at a non-profit. Then it transferred to Broadway with commercial producers, and the Public's share of the profits has been funding their work ever since. They've made tens of millions of dollars from Hamilton.
Which is the dream scenario, obviously, but it's also a real structural feature of the system. The non-profit world does the research and development, the commercial world does the scaling, and the profits from scaling flow back to the non-profit. It's not perfect, but it's a lot more functional than most people realize.
It works for playwrights and actors too. The off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway ecosystem functions as a talent pipeline. The commercial producers are watching what happens at the non-profits. The agents are watching. The casting directors are watching. If you do remarkable work in a 60-seat theater, people will notice.
Daniel, to answer your question directly, the scene is real. It's geographically concentrated in a few key neighborhoods. It spans everything from polished non-profit productions to gloriously messy storefront experiments, and you can access it for less than the price of a Broadway mezzanine seat. Start with the venues we listed. Use Show, Score, and CultureBot. Talk to people at the Drama Bookshop. And don't be afraid to see something that sounds completely inexplicable. That's the point.
If you want to start with the most reliably strange experiences, I'd say check what's playing at The Brick in Williamsburg, at La Mama on East 4th Street, and at Here Arts Center on 6th Avenue. Those 3 venues alone will give you a cross-section of what experimental New York theater looks like right now. You'll see puppetry, you'll see multimedia, you'll see devised ensemble work, you'll see solo performance. You'll see things that don't fit into any category.
You'll be sitting close enough to see the performers blink. That's the thing. The scale changes everything. Broadway is spectacle. Off-Broadway is craft. Off-off-Broadway is conversation. They're all worth experiencing, but if you want the conversation, you go small.
One last practical note. Many of these venues are in older buildings, and accessibility varies. If you have specific needs, check the venue's website before booking. Most of them are good about accommodations, but the physical infrastructure can be challenging in some of the older spaces.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Take it away, Hilbert.
In the early medieval period, before probability theory existed, gamblers on the Yamal Peninsula used reindeer knuckle bones as dice, and because the bones are naturally asymmetrical, certain outcomes were more likely than others, but no one could explain why for another 800 years, so they simply assumed the bones were displeased with them.
A lot of reindeer emotion packed into a game of chance.
I'm just impressed Hilbert found a way to connect probability theory and reindeer.
We'll be thinking about emotionally volatile knuckle bones for the rest of the day.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. Thanks to Daniel for the question. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com and on Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a review. It helps.
We'll be back next time. Until then, go see something strange.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.